is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 177. I'm recording it on Thursday, October 8th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 19. That's less than great. The title of the musical selection is Heavy Interlude. The title of the podcast is All About Back Testing. The investment strategies that are, I won't say advised. I try to watch my language. I don't really recommend investing strategies because I never went to investing school, and I'm not qualified, and I don't manage any big funds. I'm no expert. Come on. What I do is I explore investing strategies. I'm a journalist. I have a podcast not too long ago. I'm a journalist, not an investment expert. So I talk about the things that I think work, and anyway, that's what this is about. You know, the site is about. So just whenever I get to that verb, I think in the old days I used to sometimes say the investment strategies advocated or something like that at PassionSaving.com, and I do advocate them in a sense, but only in the most general way, because they're subject to change. There are ideas we're exploring together as a community, the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities, and hopefully in time, the entire internet, and hopefully in time, the entire world. I view the story of the transition from passive investing to rational investing not so much as an investing story or even as a economic story. I view it as a political story. It's a story of change, and it's a situation where we came up, I'm going to get to the topic. You just wait, but I got a little something to get off my chest first. But it's a story in which we made a wonderful stride in our understanding of how investing works in the started in the 50s and 60s, developed speed in the 70s and 80s, where we made this transition from the pre-Bogle era, which was an era of just sort of subjective opinion, guesswork, really. There were smart people, but I do feel that most of us were engaging in guesswork. And I don't think in those days, my opinion is that stock investing was not a good idea for the average middle-class person. The person willing to put some work and study into it, it was good. The returns were certainly good. But the average person who didn't really understand the lay of the land, it was too risky, in my view. That's just my view. But Bogle and others, you know, the whole passive investing group movement, changed that. They started using academic research and historical data. They rationalized the investment process. And I call that the indexing revolution. Very exciting stuff, very powerful, good stuff. The last podcast, I changed the title. I had called it, what did I call it? When I talked on the podcast, I called it the investment strategies explored at PassionSaving.com could not have been developed without the work done by the passive investing advocates. Boy, that's a mouthful. But after I listened back, I said, no, that's not a good title. I'm going to call this podcast Volatility is Optional. That's much, much shorter and much more exciting. So I switched the title. But after listening to it, I can't go back. It was a piece of writing. I would just go back and change it. But I can't go back and re-record these podcasts, or somebody smarter than me probably could. They could edit and all that sort of thing, but I don't know where those buttons are. I don't know how to do that, any of that, so forget it. But I just changed the titles. But anyway, the point of that podcast was to express gratitude to the people in the passive investing school who taught us so much. But the historical story, the historical slash political story, is they did get it wrong. They should have learned that. If they believed in following academic research, as they should have, because since that's their whole model, they should have listened to the academic research that Robert Shiller published in 1981 showing that valuations affect long-term returns. If valuations affect long-term returns, the chances of passive investing ever working in the real world in the long term are precisely zero. Because if valuations affect long-term returns, the long-term value proposition of stocks is obviously not a constant. but something that varies. And if the long-term value proposition of stocks varies, you obviously shouldn't be going with the same amount of stocks at all times. So passive investing became a nullity, you know, an impossible strategy in the early 80s, long, long time ago, almost 3 decades. But for historical reasons, the people who pushed this, I mean, I don't think they're evil people. I don't think they sat down in a room and said, "Hey, let's work a con on the American people." But I think they wanted passive investing to work, and they had come to believe it worked. They thought they were onto it something, and they were onto something, but they had exaggerated what they were onto, and they didn't want to change. And they got locked. They became rigid, and they've become increasingly rigid as the evidence has accumulated that they are wrong, and I believe strongly that they are wrong. About very basic points, which means when you're wrong on the fundamentals, you get all the details wrong. You get all the strategies wrong. As it became more and more and more evident that they were wrong, 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 they became more and more and more arrogant about never admitting it and just ignoring all that evidence. So now we're in a fix. I shouldn't laugh. But now they've sent the economy over a cliff, and now they really don't want to admit they're wrong. And if they don't admit they're wrong soon, who knows where we're going to end up, but we'll leave that sad story to another day. But I forget exactly what riff. Well, I started on this riff where I was saying, so I really try not to advocate. I don't, at least I don't intend to. You can't help but slip into that language from time to time. What I really advocate is study of valuation-informed indexing and of rational investing in general. What I advocate you do is that you not take the stock selling industry on faith. The stock selling industry makes money by promoting passive investing. Again, I don't mean to say they're evil, but would you go to the car selling industry for advice on whether to buy a car or not? It's just not a good idea. They're not capable. I don't think they're straight shooters. They're not capable of being straight shooters. There's too much money at stake, and that influences human beings, and that's just the way it is. And so we need independent people, you know, looking tough, looking with a skeptical eye. And I had not intended to be such a person, but I've become such a person through circumstances. And I see my job as, I do see it as my job to try to tear down the passive investing school, not in any sense of meanness, but to work as hard as I can to instill skepticism about it. And if people are able to come back at me and make a good case, more power to them. If passive investing survives Rob Bennett's attacks, then good for passive investing as far as I'm concerned. Maybe they'll swing me around. It's going to take a lot of work today, but maybe, who knows? Who knows? Stranger things, I suppose, have happened. But I see it as my job to instill skepticism among middle-class investors towards passive investing and to encourage middle-class investors to give a good hard look at valuation-informed indexing as a strategy and rational investing as an investing model, because I think, personally, this flawed human being who stands before you talking into this microphone, Rob Bennett, believes valuation-informed indexing is the way to go for the typical middle-class investor, and rational investing is the way to go for all of us, all of us. We need to make that transition. So I see it as, but I don't say that everything I get right. What I say is, I am right that this question needs to be discussed. That I believe strongly. And that I believe not as an investing expert, but as a journalist. Well, I'm sorry to take that detour, but I feel these points need to be explained from time to time. And I do explain them from time to time, and I'm sometimes repetitive, but not everybody listens to every podcast. And so I feel I need to get them on the record, you know, every now and again, because if you don't know what the project's about, you're going to jump to bad conclusions, and I don't want to see that happen. That, you know, you can get hurt if that happens, so I don't want that. We're playing a game here that we try to have fun, but it's potentially a dangerous game, you know. It's a game where people can get hurt if they're not careful, so, you know, we got to wear our helmets. You know, we got to have fun. We're going to go down big hills, but we got to wear helmets. So, but one thing I have in common, so all of the ideas, you know, explored at the site, valuation-informed indexing and all the rest, they share a lot of similarities. with passive indexing and with the passive investing model, because we're essentially just an outgrowth of that model. That model is something that I applaud historically. I think it was a big breakthrough. However, I greatly regret the wrong track that passive investing has gotten on since 1981. And the work I do at passionsaving.com is aimed at getting the whole thing back on the right track, getting us all back on the right track. So a question that I thought should be explored, this especially came to mind after yesterday's podcast where I was tracing that history, where passive investing got on the wrong track and how I would like to get it back on the right track. The question of backtesting, because it's probably the most, if something I often say is I'll say there's no intellectual argument against valuation-informed indexing. Just so you know what I'm talking about, valuation-informed indexing. I presume you know what indexing is. Indexing is instead of buying individual stocks, you buy a broad index like the S&P. That's John Bogle recommends that. But John Bogle recommends passive indexing. So you buy, he agrees that setting your allocation is important. Total agreement with Rob Bennett. So he says spend some time figuring out your allocation. But once you do that, just say you pick 70% as your allocation, stick with that. Don't change it. That's passive. The thing passive investors are passive about is their allocation. I say that's crazy and dangerous and wrongheaded and just all mixed up, all kinds of weird. I say the value proposition, because of Shiller's research showing that valuations affect long-term returns, we know that valuations affect long-term returns. Bogle acknowledges this. He's not in disagreement. And if valuations affect long-term returns, you must change your stock allocation. Not necessarily every year. Might be only every 10 years, but on average. But you've got to do it. That no rational argument can be made not for not changing your allocation, says Rob Bennett. And I personally think that's common sense. I don't see how anybody can dispute it. And sometimes I will say, nobody disputes this intellectually. And I think that's true. We've had 7.5 years of discussions at the various boards and blogs. And, truth be told, no one's ever made an argument. No one's ever engaged me in an intellectual back and forth. I mean, on particular points they have, and sometimes they make good points on particular points. But on the general question of whether valuations affect long-term returns, no one ever disputes it. So what I get instead is a lot of, bricks being thrown at me, a lot of personal attacks, and that's nowheresville. That's just degrading for the people doing it, I think. Degrading for the communities in which it's practiced. It's degrading for human beings, in my opinion. Just bad. But if there's one intellectual argument that has a little bit of credibility, a little bit of firepower to it, that they make against valuation-informed indexing, it is that valuation-informed indexing is the product of backtesting. So I think it's worthy of a podcast to explore that question. Is valuation-informed indexing a product of backtesting? And is that a bad thing? And is that a reason why you should be skeptical? So I think I've touched on it a little bit. Maybe I touched on it probably. I had a podcast called The Case Against Valuation-Informed Indexing. I probably touched on it in that one. But I'll go in more depth. So let's start at the very beginning. That's a very good place to start. Who told us that? Mary Poppins? I think it was really Sound of Music, but same actress as Mary Poppins. I once had a goon. One time we were having discussions. This was I find it funny. Probably nobody else does, but we were having some kind of discussion of Vanguard diehards, and everybody was on the attack mode. These goons, and somebody said, they were comparing the grainy site and my site. That grainy site has all, intellectual information, very good information. That passionsaving.com is a Mary Poppins type site. And I said, "Oh, you've gone too far now. Now you're going to have a smear campaign against Mary Poppins? This is over the line." Buster. Anybody that finds fault with Mary Poppins, you don't want to take investing advice from such people. This is the level of you know, pomposity that passive investing breeds. You know, I have to say that. I mean, it's a hard hit, but man, when they take on Mary Poppins, you just have to say, what is it with these people? What is it with these people? All right. So what is backtesting? Let's just, you know, start at the beginning. Let's understand what we're talking about. Because I don't think, you know, they use these terms like dirty words, you know. It's like saying you peddle smut, you know, you backtest. You know, everybody can tell from the context in which they say it that it's a bad thing. But I believe that 60% of the people listening into the discussions don't even know what backtesting is. One of the shocking things I found. I'm going down a lot of detours today, but you know, we used to discuss the Graney Safe Withdrawal Rate Study. If you want to check out the study, it's his website is retireearlyhomepage.com. We used to, back at the Motley Fool board, we would discuss that study, Safe Withdrawal Rates, how much you can take out of your retirement portfolio safely. We would discuss that every day. This was back in 1999, 2000. Every day, somebody would have a thread on that. And excuse me. And boy, I lost my train of thought on that. What was I going to say? We discuss it every day. Boy, I don't remember. I'm sorry. Don't remember. Well, we better explain backtesting. That's what I intended to do. What is backtesting? When I listen back, I'm going to remember what I meant to say, and I'm going to feel sad. But I think I'm going to have to let that one go. I don't think it was too critical. But what is backtesting? Backtesting is it's something that comes up in investing discussions all the time. Oh, this is it. I got it. We used to discuss that study every day. And so the impression you would get is that this discussion board community, everybody knew all about the study, you know? And then, of course, this nuclear bomb. When on May 13th, 2002, when I said the study's analytically invalid, it was like a nuclear bomb. It was the most, you know, it was the biggest explosion in the history of the internet. I swear, people, go back and check. It was unreal. It's still going on today. It's like the poison gas is still in the air. 7.5 years later. And you would think, you know, of course, we proved the case. It wasn't as if, you know, I just was giving my opinion. We proved it on the sixth day. We looked at the data and we showed that we did a sensitivity study showing. That was on the sixth day, and we came up with more proof later on, and we had experts saying we were right. I mean, just every way you could prove it. But the truth of the matter is, most people on that board didn't know what the study said. In other words, what you get on a discussion board is people contribute when they know what they're talking about. But when the subject is something they don't really understand, they don't disagree, certainly. They wouldn't challenge the study because they'd be scared their heads would be cut off. But they don't really even ask questions. Most people just go into silence. And so what happens is other people listening in think, well, nobody's challenging this study. It must be right. The average person thinks there's thousands of people participating, and they've been participating every day. They discuss it every day for, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years. It must be right. And the reality is, I don't know, maybe 70% of the people don't even know what the study says. So there's a tiny number that have even ever read it. I don't know what the number is. There's no way to know. But it came out, you know, as we got into the discussions, because we'd be having these back and forth discussions with people expressing all kinds of vehemence, you know, and somebody would ask this basic question. Like, they would ask all the time. People didn't know. They'd say, when you do the study, when they do these old school safe withdrawal rate studies, what they do is they assume that your portfolio was depleted to zero at the end of 30 years. The theory is you retire at 65, so you only need your money to last to 95. So when they say 4% withdrawal, they don't mean take out 4% and you still have your portfolio at the end of 30 years. They mean you deplete it to zero. And people didn't know that. Lots of people didn't know that. Now, there's no crime in that, but it just points out the danger of the internet because people listening in, they think that everybody's on the same page. And the reality is everybody is not on the same page. This is how misinformation spreads. People don't even know what these studies say. There were people planning their retirements according to them. People were thinking these people must know. And of course, it's not just Grainy that does this. Bogle and all these other people, they don't necessarily do it intentionally. I don't think I well, I think in some cases they might a little bit take advantage of the lack of knowledge, but I don't think as a general proposition they're taking advantage of it intentionally. But oh, in other words, the moral of the story is please learn the basics. Don't take anything. My view on investing is never invest in something you don't understand. Never agree with a theory if you don't understand what lies behind it, because you'll get it's better not to know things than to fake it. It's better to just say, I don't know, and I'm going to stick to the basics. That's why valuation-informed indexing is so basic. Two asset classes: Treasury inflation-protected securities, which are the most simple asset class on planet Earth to understand, and a broad index fund, which is pretty simple. As long as you understand valuations, you've got it. And that's not hard because we look at price in everything else we buy. But, by all means, get into the more sophisticated stuff if you care to learn. But if you don't care to learn, don't do it, because that's how you get killed. And I have seen it up close and personal. All right. I really have to get into the definition of backtesting, or we're gonna clock in at 70 minutes again. All right. Backtesting is. See, what happens in one of the problems we have, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but with investing, we have numbers. We have theories and we have numbers. So everybody has a theory. You invest my way and everybody else is wrong and I'm right. And everybody says that. And, how are you going to win the argument? Well, the way people win the argument is they say, hey, here's the record. Look, mine works. And of course, if you listen to the other side, they say the same thing. And of course, they're just using different parts of the record, or they're doctoring it in different ways to make it look good. So everybody's playing the same game. But in theory, the fact that investing is a numbers game should be a good thing, because it should make it hard for, people trying to BS us. It should make it hard for them to do it. Because if all they're doing is pushing a BS idea, we should be able to call them out on it because the numbers won't work. But unfortunately, the people making the BS claims are able to go in and doctor the data in about 1,000 different ways. And so it's the old Mark Twain quote, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. You would think that the fact that we have an historical record would help us see through the BS. But in reality, it helps the BS artists push their gibberish. Because they're spending more time. They could spend the time to doctor the data properly, and we're just sort of listening in, and it's not our life. And so we're always behind them. They're always one step ahead of us. So the phrase that people use to try to call out the BS artist is backtesting. So almost every time somebody, well, they use it two ways, really. That it's a strange word, Usually a word has a good connotation or a bad connotation. Backtesting, I've seen it used probably 50% good and 50% bad. When it's their idea they're trying to convince you of, you'll say, well, why should we all believe in your idea? And they'll say, oh, well, our idea is the only one that backtests well. And then it's like, oh, backtesting is science. Oh, it's very good, backtesting. And then when you say, well, wait a minute, this other guy's study, his looks pretty good. Oh, that's an obvious case of backtesting. Then backtesting is this dirty word. It just switches. It's a verb that can mean it's the greatest thing on the planet, or it's the worst thing on the planet, depending on, whether you like it or you don't like it. Backtesting can be a dirty word or a term of endearment. So what does backtesting mean? What backtesting means is you take a theory, you take an idea, and you check the record to see if it stands up. That's what backtesting means. Now, I'll give you an example or two so you get the idea of hopefully neutral examples, so you won't think I'm spinning. To give you an idea of how backtesting can be used, both for good and bad purposes. Say someone, I know that there's a theory out there, and I don't study all these things in depth, I don't care to, but I know there's a theory out there about there are certain months on which it's better to own stocks and other months when it's better not to. I believe that January is supposed to be a good month, and I'm almost sure October is supposed to be a bad month. We're heading into where we're in October now. So as a rule, people will say, oh, January is a good month on stocks. October's a bad month. Some people will say, buy, go all in for the first half of the year, January through June, and go all out from July through December. And just do that. And they say if you do that every year, this is just one idea. There's lots of these, but this is I'm just giving an example. If you do that, you'll earn, your the average, you'll get a return of, I don't know, double what everybody else gets. It's all the good years. Now, all the good months are in the beginning, all the bad months in the end. Now, if somebody just said to do that, everybody would say, well, that's, crazy. I mean, why would I want to do that? It doesn't make any sense. Backtesting, backtesting, here's the backtest. So what they'll do is they'll take the backtest. They'll say, well, here's what would happen if you had followed this. And usually when they backtest, they do actually calculate the numbers properly. This was the defense they used to give the Graney study. Well, he calculated the numbers properly. Well, they always calculate the numbers properly. The question is, does the theory make any sense? So I don't know. I don't know for a fact that if you went all in 100% stocks from January through June and 0% from July through December, I don't know whether that back tests well or not. But I think people say that. They say something like that. I may have misunderstood. I don't care. I just don't care. But let's just say that that back tests well. Does that make it a good strategy? I hope that your answer is no. Now, does it make it a bad strategy? That you're, I hope your answer to that is also no. In other words, the fact that it backtests well is certainly not enough evidence for you to put your money in it. Okay. But it's not enough evidence not to put your money in it either. In other words, the fact that it backtests well, I don't know, depending on the circumstances, it could be significant. It could be virtually insignificant, but not entirely so, or it could be highly significant, depending on the circumstances. If all you told me about the strategy is, the only thing we know is that going with 100% stocks from January through June, zero from July through December, if all I knew about that strategy was that it backtests well, I would say that's a minor plus. I wouldn't call it a minus. The fact that it has worked historically has to be a plus. But I would count that as a very small plus. In other words, a back test with that's not accompanied by logic, a logical explanation of why this should work, is not quite worthless, but almost so. It counts for very little. If you don't have a theory, you're just saying, I don't know why, but for some reason these are good months. Now, what usually the people using back testing will do is they will supply a theory. So, for example, I don't know what theory they would give, but they might say, they might say at the end of the year, people are getting out of stocks because for some tax reason or something. I don't know. So the point would be that there's a reason. They give some logic for why stocks would go down in at the end of the year, and then of course after the tax consequence, doesn't matter anymore. They would put their money back in. That would explain why it would do well in January in the early months. So that there's certain people who have lots of money who are sort of jumping in and out, and when they jump in the early months, stocks boom, and when they jump out, stocks sag, and you can get a free ride by just doing the same thing they do because they're pushing prices up, and you want prices to go up. And they're pushing prices down. You don't want to own stocks when they go down. So now you've got logic plus back testing. Well, now it's better. It's not something I'm going to invest my money on, but it is a little better than what we had before. So now you've got a theory plus back testing. And this is, the description I just gave is pretty much The criticism, probably the most effective criticism aimed at valuation-informed indexing, is that valuation-informed indexing is the product of backtesting. And of course, it does have logic. The logic is that the price you pay affects the long-term value proposition. So they'll say, okay, it's sort of like that argument that, you know, there's some tax consequence that people get out. And it backtests well. The problem with backtesting, the intellectual flaw, the theory, you see, you can't really prove. The problem with the theory is, you know, is it true that tax consequences cause rich people to sell their stocks? I don't know, and I don't know if anybody knows. It might be, there probably is anecdotal evidence that it's been true in some cases, but how many cases does it have to be true for it to be a good strategy to follow? Who knows? I don't think anybody knows. So by itself, the theory is the more important thing. The question is the theory right? If the theory's right, it makes sense to consider it in forming your investment strategy. But there's really no way to test the theory except backtesting, and backtesting is dangerous because the problem with backtesting is if you first come up with the theory and then you backtest, backtesting is a quote-unquote scientific way to, I don't want to say confirm the theory, but to support the theory. If you do it in that order. Because say you had this theory that, you know, people sell stocks at the end to for tax reasons, whatever reason, and they buy in the new year. Say that's your theory. If that theory is pure nonsense, the odds are it would not backtest well. So if you had the theory first and then you tested it and it backtested well, it's not proof, but it is evidence that there's something there. It's an oddity that it happened to backtest well, and it's suggestive of there being something real there. Now, but there are a couple of problems. One is, do we have enough data? That's a big problem. And there's three that I know of. There are three time periods where people use data. John Walter Russell is the one who does the data for all our calculators at the website and at his website. John's site is early hyphen retirement hyphen planning hyphen insights.com. John does all the statistical work. We don't let Rob near the numbers. Rule number one. We usually go from 1921 forward. That's called the modern era of investing. So we're usually looking at 90 years of data. Now, when you're looking at data, you always want more. I mean, 90 years we think is adequate. Some say no. Some say that's not enough. There are different ways of measuring whether it's enough. John has something he calls degrees of freedom, which is a statistical term that I don't really understand. I have a vague idea what it means. You could look it up, I'm sure, on Wikipedia. But he says that the degrees of freedom are sufficient for statistically significant findings. And he knows a whole lot more about statistics than I do, and good chance he knows more than you. Not certain, but there's a good chance. He knows more than a lot of people, I'm sure of that. So you want as much data as you can get. But we tend to use, John feels it's generally better to use 1921 forward, and that's what most researchers do in this field. Shiller goes back to 1870. He has data going back to 1870 at his website, and John will use that data on occasion. Like in the stock return predictor, we give returns 10 years out, 20, 30, 40, 50, and 60. And for the 40, 50, and 60, you can't come up with a meaningful prediction of the return with only 80 years of data. In order to get a meaningful prediction, what is it? What do we have? 90 years, right? 90 years from 20 to 2010 is 90 years. You can't get meaningful predictions, so we have to go back to 1870 for those numbers. So when we have to go back, we do, and when we can get meaningful numbers only going from 21 forward, that's what we do. Jeremy Siegel, my understanding, is that he goes back to like 1800. He goes back further. He has a database that goes back further. I have, you know, Jeremy Siegel wrote Stocks for the Long Run. So he's the other big researcher other than Shiller. And most people go from the 20s forward, but some will go to 1870. And Siegel, some people follow Siegel's lead and go back to 1800. But there have been criticisms of Siegel's data that goes back to 1800, arguments that it's not really good data. I can't say. It's not for me to say. My sense of things is that it sounds as though the criticisms are legitimate, that there are problems with the data. However, my sense of things from reading Siegel's book is that his findings aren't that much different from what the passive investors find who only use data from 1870 forward. So I'm not sure it really made a difference. In other words, it may be that his data is not good, the earlier data. I sort of think so, but I'm not really sure it made any difference, because what really matters is how you interpret the data. And if you interpret it from a passive investing standpoint, you come to the same conclusion, whether you go back to 1800 or 1870 or 1920. But if you interpret it from a rational investing standpoint, you'll come up with the same the same general finding, regardless of whether you go back to 1800, 1870, or 1920. So I think that's the more important factor, is how you interpret it, what your model is. So one problem with, I was citing a problem, you know, with the idea that if you find something back test well, one problem is, you know, is the did you have sufficient data? Did you have sufficient data? And, you know, one answer to that is, you know, we only have so much data. I mean, you know, we can't create it. It's not like we can go out in the backyard and dig up some more data. And, of course, one way you can try to get more data is to go farther back in the record like Siegel did. But the problem you have with that is then people are going to criticize you that, see, the data's not good, that we don't have good records. So you have to sort of, you know, add things, you know, and that colors the, you know, that can color the research. You're trying to prove a certain point, and now your subjectivity gets into it. You're losing objectivity. The whole point of data is to make the analysis objective. And if you start, you know, deciding what gets in and what gets out, you get into troubles. And this is a problem that it plagues all investment research. You know, one of the things I'll say all the time is, I'll say that the, you know, the long-term return, the average long-term return is 6.5. That depends on how far back you go. My understanding is if you go back to 1870, it's been a long time since I looked at this, but my understanding is if you went back to 1870, long-term return is 6%, not 6.5. But if you go from 1921, it's 6.5. And some people will go from like 1960 and they'll say, oh, it's 7. But see, that finding is being influenced by the fact that you had this huge bull market, the biggest bull market in history in the 80s and 90s. So after the end of this bear market, it might be down to 6 again. You see, because we may be having a big drop coming up ahead. We had a big drop last year. We may have another one in another year or two. And then the long-term return is going to be back at 6. So all these pieces are moving pieces. But you can't, I feel like people jump to two conclusions. Some people will say data is everything. And the passives tend to do this. They tend to be, the data says it, that's the end of the story, no discussion. They're very arrogant and dogmatic. It annoys me greatly, you can probably tell. And that is just dangerous, because there always are caveats. There always are uncertainties. There's always changes. History doesn't repeat exactly, but it does rhyme. So, you know, stocks are probably going to perform in the future somewhat as they have in the past, but not precisely so. And so you've got to always have a degree of caution in your comments. You know, none of us are perfect at this, but we should try. And I feel like the passives are sometimes they don't even try. They're just dogmatic in the way they say things. However, the other extreme is people will say, data is misleading. You can't use data. Well, if you don't use data, you got nothing to go by. All you've got is subjective opinion. And one person's subjective opinion is as good as another's. What it, you've, I really don't understand how you can come to any understanding of investing without looking at some kind of data. Everybody's got a theory, and if you can't test them, so my view is a middle ground view. The data is very important, but it is secondary to theory. Theory comes first. And so now, as I say, the one criticism about valuation informed indexing that I feel is oh, I was going to mention, I wanted to mention one other theory, and then I'll move to this. One of the theories, some of these theories can be interesting. One of the theories, I mentioned how I don't personally believe the idea about getting stocks early in the year and then get out. But I haven't studied it. I'm not dogmatic about it. Maybe there's something to it. My view is the theory doesn't strike me as compelling. For example, it could be, the 1929 crash, there was a big drop in prices in October. So it could be that just by an historical fluke, there was this big crash, and because the data set is not that big, that one crash had a disproportionate effect. And that's why it's a bad idea to hold stocks at the end of the year, or at least it appears to be. But if that's the case, then it was just a quirk, and there's really no greater risk holding them in October than there is holding them in January. But I don't know. I guess the way I would say, and I actually feel this way about life in general, you have to be careful how strongly you believe things. My view is what a lot of people do is they believe lots of things in a sort of vague way. In other words, they hear something in the news and they sort of believe it. And often, it doesn't hold up if you check it out. And my feeling is I'd rather know a few things and dig really deep and understand them well. So what I do in investing is I just take a pass on all kinds of things. I just, like I say, I just don't study them, don't care to. And I'm not dogmatic. I don't say they're dumb. I just say doesn't strike my fancy. But then when something like valuation seems to me to be important, I study it to death. So I've got it cold. And I'll stand, I've said this before, but I'll stand on the stage with John Bogle, the leading investment expert in the world. I have no fear that he's going to say something about. Now, if they say we're going to turn the topic to, debentures, I'm going to say, I have a bus to catch, people. I know nothing about debentures. But if we're talking about valuations, yeah, I can stand toe to toe with John Bogle, and I can stand toe to toe, frankly, with Robert Shiller. I'd be more afraid with Robert Shiller, but I think I could do it. Nobody. I'd stand toe to toe with Warren Buffett on valuations. He'd be the one I'd be most afraid of. But because he can tell jokes, he can make fun of me. So he would worry me. Charlie Munger, maybe not. Maybe I wouldn't want to be on the stage with Charlie Munger. He's tough. He's tough. But I'm just saying. If I know my stuff, I know my stuff, and I'd rather know a few things well than a lot of things not so well. Because when you know things not so well, you get in, just enough to get in trouble. Just enough information to be dangerous. So I'd rather dig. And this is my view of investing is, find what you're going to invest in and study that thing until you know it. And if you know it, put your money in it. And if you don't have the time, and most of us don't, take a pass. So if you don't have time to pick it, this is why I like John Bogle. He says, if you don't have time to study individual stocks, just don't bother. Buy an index fund. You don't need the hassle. If you've got the time, I say do it. Most of us don't. Most of us don't have the time or the inclination. So, there's this theory, another, just to give another theory on back testing. You don't hear this as much nowadays, but people used to say it. They used to say, oh, when skirts rise, stock prices rise. I remember hearing that a lot in the old days. And again, it sounds nuts. What the heck? Just the length of skirts have to do with anything. People sort of laugh at it. But of course, people backtest. If you backtest it, you can find support for it. And then they'll say, well, you've got to give a theory. Well, there is a theory. And the theory is not crazy. The theory is, you'll hear me often in these podcasts, I'll talk about there have been four times we've tried passive investing. Passive investing is investing in stocks without regard to price, buying stocks and not worrying about the price at which they're sold. We've tried it four times. It's brought economic disaster for everybody following it every time it's been tried, and an economic crisis for the entire country, even people that didn't invest in stocks, every time. No exceptions in the record. We've never had an economic crisis in the United States from 1900 forward, except for the four times passive investing became popular, and we're four for four with that one. Always brings an economic crisis. Well, what are the four times? The last one is the 1990s, and we don't have a complete record on that. We're still halfway through the reaction to that, so we don't know how it's going to turn out. It might turn out very bleak. Let's pray it doesn't, but we don't know. The first case was so long ago, none of us around today know it, except the historians. That was the early 1900s. There was an economic crisis. There was a stock crash, and that's about all I know. And the P10 level was very high, and there was a crash, and there was an economic crisis. But the two other times were the late 1920s. P10 was off the charts. We had a stock crash and a huge economic crisis called the Depression, and the same thing in the mid 60s. P10 off the charts, stock crash, economic crisis in the 70s, stagflation. Well, what some people noticed was, in the 20s, we had this thing called the Roaring 20s, and we had the flapper girls and all this kind of thing. And so, it was a time where, people were starting to drive cars. It was just, people, I think, were drinking. This was the speakeasies and all this sort of thing. Jazz was becoming popular. In other words, there was a certain feeling in the air of freedom, personal freedom, that we hadn't experienced before. Some people think it's good, some people think bad, but that's not for me to say. But that correspond, that could potentially, I shouldn't say it does, potentially, that could correspond with high stock prices. When people start feeling confident and easy and happy and not worried, they say, hey, I'm not worried about the price of stocks. What are you, some old fogey looking at P10? I'm hip, I'm with it. I like jazz. I'm going to P1026. That's not a problem. Stocks for the long run, buy and hold. Timing doesn't work. And the same thing in the 60s. We had the swinging 60s and the go-go girls and all this sort of thing. Time of freedom. What had happened was we had lived through the Depression, which was a sad thing. We had lived through the Second World War, which was a scary thing. Then when we got back from the war, all people wanted to do was to be safe at home. They just said, I'm glad I don't have to worry about bombs falling on me. I'm going to raise a family and be safe. But, that was 46. And then by the time we got to 66, the kids born in the baby boom were going to college. And they did, they had never lived through the Depression. They had never lived through the Second World War. They had more on their mind in terms of, freedom and fulfillment and all this sort of thing. Good or bad, you decide. That kind of environment may or may not, but it may, it's a plausible theory, it may lead to high stock prices, which leads to crashes. So there's just a cycle here. So the idea, an idea that on the surface sounds nuts, that high stock prices are correlated to skirts, above the knee, it's not necessarily a crazy idea. Now in the 90s, did we have skirts above the knee? We'll see. That's where you have to get into history may sometimes rhyme. people will have to decide what they think. I'm not aware of skirts rising, but an argument could be made that we became more lax in certain types of decorum, that we became more, we started having, what would they call it? not informal day at work. Used to be men would come to work in hats, There was a guy in one of the consulting firms I worked for. He used to wear a hat to the office. And he was just an old timer, and that's what he used to do. But, we started having casual Fridays, and so maybe that was the equivalent of skirts rising. We had the internet, people engaging in self-expression on the internet. We had all this sort of thing. We had, sex scandal, the present saying, it depends what the meaning of word is, all this sort of thing, which arguably is equivalent to what we saw in the 60s and the 20s. So what I'm trying to say is that's the theory. But the theory isn't worth much unless you can confirm it. You confirm it through what's called backtesting. Now, if you do the backtesting, you can support it. You can make a nice chart showing whenever there's, moral laxity, equals high skirts, and all of these things are, of course, cartoonish. You get high stock prices. But the danger is, if you went in there looking for a correlation, maybe you stretch the data a little bit to make it work. In other words, it's there, but is it really there? Are you just seeing it? Did the high skirts, maybe the high skirts really started in 1918 and stock prices were low then. I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying you can play with these things. And so you've always got to look at who's doing the interpretation. But you can't throw out back testing because without back testing, we got nothing to go by. Back testing is not necessarily a bad thing. Back testing is a way of confirming a theory. The question is just, is it, what kind of person is doing it? Is a fair-minded person or not? Now, I mentioned that the only real intellectual argument I've heard against valuation-informed indexing, evaluation-informed indexing back tests well. This is pretty much universally accepted. Norbert Schenkler, I have a, if you go on the front page of the blog, go down the left-hand side, I have a section called, the blog is called Rich Life at passionsaving.com. Go down the left-hand side, there's a section called People Are Talking. And one of the people I quote, it's a bunch of people who have said things, usually kind things, about the site or about the ideas. And one of them is Norbert Schenkler. And Norbert Schenkler is a goon's goon. Norbert Schenkler hates my guts, I think it'd be fair to say. He's a co-owner of a discussion board called, I forget the name of it. Can't remember the name of it. But it's a do-it-yourself kind of site. I know it's a Canadian site. But Financial Webbring Forum, that's it. Well, Norbert posted a lot of boards, and he's always been abusive to me from the first day. I think I bug him because, he thinks he's giving this do-it-yourself advice to investors, and I'm saying it's bogus. He's a big passive investing guy. But to Norbert's total credit, he did a thread one time at Financial Webbring Forum where he basically back-tested valuation-informed indexing. And it's a great thread. He's totally fair in his comments. He doesn't support it. He doesn't endorse it, but totally fair-minded. And he says, yeah, it actually backtests well. It looks good. Now, he made an interesting. So I quote him there on the homepage, and his quote is extraordinary. Maybe I can pull it up. It's extraordinary when you consider that, that he hates me. He says, see if it'll come up. The quote is just extraordinary. If I can, I'm almost there. Let's see. Well, you can never find something. Here it is. The evidence is pretty incontrovertible. Valuation-informed indexing is everywhere superior to buy and hold over 10-year periods. Norbert Schenkler, co-owner of the Financial Webbring Forum. Well, that's an incredible statement. He's saying it always works through the historical record. It's true. Now, I brought this up somewhere the other day, and one of the grainy goons came forward and said, "Oh, you left out a sentence." And it's true, I did. There's a sentence there where Norbert says, "Oh yeah, it everywhere works except in the mid-90s doesn't work." And there's a sense in which this, I don't know what the goon was. What, he didn't give his name, I don't think. But there's a sense in which he's right to bring that up. Because what Norbert was suggesting is, he was saying, yeah, it looks like it always works. However, Shiller discovered this stuff in the 80s. And now the first time it's been tested where it's not back testing, where it's been tested on a going forward basis, it doesn't work. Well, that's the classic sign of back testing not working. In other words, you go backwards to prove something, and then when it goes forwards, it no longer works. And that's the criticism that's directed at valuation-informed indexing. So Norbert, as I say, fair-minded right up. He said, look, it does backtest well. However, from the 90s, it doesn't appear to be working. And that's a sign of poor backtesting, I'm not persuaded. And that's fine. That's good. We have two critics that complain about the backtesting. We have goons that are just out to destroy, smash and destroy, and we'd be better off without them. And we have skeptics. And in that case, Norbert was being a skeptic. And that's healthy and good. Helps us. The reason I don't include the quote, though, there at the homepage of the blog is, the exception about the 1990s no longer applies. And we've now had a stock crash. And if you backed, you know, he wrote that before the crash. But if you went back, if you redid his work after the crash, now it works. So Norbert is just wrong. Now, he wasn't wrong when he wrote it. It just turned out wrong. But I don't think you have to include that quote, given that it no longer applies. So I don't include it. So what you have now is a strong case. What you've got with valuation-informed indexing is it's worked. First of all, the theory is as solid as can be. The theory is the price you pay for stock should affect the long-term value proposition. Well, that, I don't know how anybody can argue the logic of that. In other words, if that wasn't, if the theory, you know, when somebody says buying stocks in the first 6 months should always be better than the last six, that's sort of a crazy theory. You know, maybe it's true, but it doesn't sound right. But the idea that price should affect the long-term value proposition, what could be more obvious? You know, the amazing thing would be if you found out it wasn't so. So you've got to start with I think you have to start with the presumption that it is true and disprove it, not the other way. The passives like to do it the other way. They say, let's presume it's false. I think you should presume it's true. But then on top of it, you've got an entire historical record in which it's always worked. So it's not like we have a solid theory that's questioned by the backtesting. We've got a solid theory that is confirmed by the backtesting. But we had one little weakness, that it hadn't worked on a going forward basis from the time Shiller, you know, wrote his papers, his research. But now we have that. In other words, Shiller came out on a public stage, said this should work going forward. He gave specific predictions. People laughed at him, passive investors, and then it worked. So you've got, you don't only have backtesting. I don't know what that's called when it works on a going forward basis. I think the statisticians have a term for it. You know, real-time confirmation. I don't know what it's called. But we now have that. So we've got absolutely rock-solid theory, rock-solid backtesting, and it's worked on a going-forward basis in a real-world test. People got on a stage, made predictions that everybody heard, and then it worked going forward. So, you know, does that mean that we're 100% sure it will always work? No, you just can't get that. And, you know, maybe if we had 10,000 years of data, you could get that. But if we had 10,000 years of data, the first 9,800 years would be in an economic environment so different from today's that it probably wouldn't count. So we're never going to have more than 130 years of data or 140 years of data. We just can't, because the world changes. So all I can say is that valuation-informed indexing has the most proof any theory in investing could ever have. That I will say. I can't imagine how you could have more proof than have a theory that's rock solid, common sense, an entire historical record backing it up for 140 years, and it's worked on a going forward basis. It's not backtesting, but, you know, after announcing it, it's worked. I don't know what else you could have. Now, I will say, in my case, this is not the product of backtesting. In other words, I posted on Motley Fool, and this can be checked. I said the historical data would support this. And I had looked at the data, but I wasn't capable of studying it. I just don't have the skills. And I was asking the community there to study it. And the goons were saying, oh, we're not gonna study it. And I said, well, do what you please, you know, but I am certain that it would work. Why? How could I be certain when I hadn't studied it? Because common sense says it has to be. How could there ever be a world in which valuations would not affect long-term returns? It's insanity. How could the price you pay not affect the value proposition? So that's not backtesting, you know. Backtesting is when you look at the data, or at least it's not the bad kind of backtesting. The bad kind of backtesting is when you look at the data first and then you create a theory to explain it. That's convoluted and not, you know, not proper. But when you have the theory first, what you're doing is confirming the theory. And the theory is not some pie in the sky thing. The theory is just plain old common sense that stocks are like anything else you can buy. Price affects the result. Just what you would expect to find. So I did not backtest. The theory is solid. It's now been tested going forward. And the last point I would make is, and this is the killer, this is the one that just kills me, slays me. The entire passive investing model is the product of backtesting. How dare these people criticize valuation-informed indexing on grounds that it's backtested when the entire passive investing model is the product of backtesting? And it is. How often these people will refer to Jeremy Siegel and stocks for the long run. That's their whole case. The whole reason. When they say timing doesn't work, where do you think that comes from? It didn't just pop into their heads. It's the product of backtesting. So they're saying to me, Rob, you know, we your theory makes sense, but we can't follow it because it's backtesting. I say, huh? Why do you believe the timing doesn't work? Backtesting, right? Oh, yeah, well, that's backtesting that supports us. All backtesting that supports us is good. All backtesting that doesn't support us is bad. I mean, either backtesting is good or it isn't. But they'll say the data isn't enough to show that valuation-informed indexing always works. But it's good enough to show that passive works? The data is the data. We both sides are using the same data. Now, what's going on? What's going on is not a debate about backtesting. What's going on was summed up very well in a sentence that I put forward this weekend. Sometimes these things just pop out of me, and I was very happy with this one. It was a discussion at the Motivator blog. And the guy had said, he kept referring to valuation-informed indexing as a scheme. And this is standard passive investing lingo. They like to use the word scheme because it's such, you know, it doesn't, they don't have to prove anything. They just sort of use dirty words. And they try to, you know, smear and lead the reader into thinking there's something wrong with it. So I said, I object to the word scheme. And he said, well, sorry. He said, but anything that involves timing, I view as a scheme. So his very premise is that this can't work. And the way he said it was, I said, well, if I said, fine, if you want to call it a scheme, call it a scheme. But passive investing is a scheme. They're both schemes. And he said, well, no, passive investing isn't a scheme. Yours is a scheme because you're trying to beat the market. And I said, well, if rational investing is a scheme to beat the market, passive investing is a scheme to beat common sense. And that sums it up, friends and neighbors. That's what's going on here. It's a question of, and look, he's sincere. The guy believes in passive investing. It's clear to me. He believes in his heart, mind, and soul that what matters is the market. And if the market sets the price is right. That's what he believes. And I believe in common sense. And common sense says price has to affect the long-term return. And if price affects the long-term return and the market has priced stocks at 3x fair value, the market is wrong. So it's absolutely true that I'm saying that you can beat the market. That is absolutely true. I have no problem with that criticism. But I also think it's true that the passive investors are saying that they can beat common sense. Common sense says you must look at price when setting your allocation, and they're trying to get away with not doing it. And you can't, you got to choose one path or the other. Either you choose to defy the market or you choose to defy common sense. I have no problem if someone openly says, I'm going with the market. Well, fine, more power to you. But don't deny that you're defying common sense, because you are. If you're saying there's no need to adjust your stock allocation when prices change dramatically, you are acting in defiance of common sense. So see, the dispute between passive and rational is a dispute about the core premise. Is the market the thing you're going to hitch your wagon to, or is common sense the thing you're going to hitch your wagon to? And I don't trust. You can back test and find support for either position. But the people on the other side can see the flaws. In other words, they can come up with studies that show that timing doesn't work. But the only way they can do it is by looking at short-term timing. They set the studies up to see whether timing works in 6 months or a year. And you could produce 1,000 studies showing that, because it's true. Timing doesn't work in 6 months or a year. But if you set it up to look for whether it works in 10 years, you can come up with 1,000 studies showing it always does work, because timing always does work in 10 years. Why? because emotions determine stock prices in the short term, and economic realities determine stock prices in the long term. So short-term timing is never going to work because you can't predict emotion. There's nothing to grab hold of. And long-term timing is always going to work because you can predict the economic realities. The U.S. productivity is a predictable number. You can't predict it with absolute precision. But it's for many, many years, as long as the stock market, as long as we have records, it's been 6.5 real. And obviously, if you're overvalued, it's going to be less. If you're undervalued, it's going to be more. So you just make a valuation adjustment, and you've got it. You know your long-term return. And so that's the dispute. And both sides have an argument. They say trust the market. I say trust common sense. And both sides have backtesting. But it's how you craft the backtesting determines what results you get. If you include valuation adjustment in the backtesting, it's always going to support valuation-informed indexing. If you don't include a valuation adjustment, it's always going to support passive. It's like looking at the same picture, you know, through two lenses. Can either of us ever prove with 100% certainty? I don't think so. But I think, well, anyway, I obviously think taking valuations into consideration is what makes sense. And they don't. But the point is, it's not because I backtest. They backtest too. We both backtest, and we're both backtesting the same data. It's all a question of what you believe determines what you see in the backtest. And if you care to find out the timing never works, you can create a study to show that. All you have to do is limit your study to cases that only go out 1 year. But if you want to show the timing always works, you can do that. And to do that, all you have to do is have the thing go out 10 years, and then it will always work. So it's all in how you set it up. You have to have backtesting. Don't throw backtesting out, because you've got to have some objective way to test your theory. But just because some person came up with a study that shows it's wrong, you've got to be skeptical, because that person may have a bias, and the bias determines how the backtesting is constructed. I want to look quickly at my notes too. I mean, I think, you know, on a going forward basis, the key here is we need a national debate so that we can sort this out. What we have today is the passive investing advocates shouting people down who question their ideas. And you see, as I say, we're never going to have absolute proof one way or the other. It's just, it's not a subject on which there's enough data available to have absolute proof. But the data is not weak. Sometimes they will say, oh, you don't have enough data. Well, we don't have as much as we'd like, but it's not weak. It's statistically valid. The amount of data we have is enough to make statistically valid conclusions. And of course, it's the same data that the passive investors use. And you have to invest some way. You can't just say none of them are, you know, the data's not good enough to prove anything. So what are you going to do? Not invest? You've got to invest. You've either got to invest passively or rationally. I don't know that there are any other choices. Either take valuations into account or you don't take valuations into account. Those are the only two possibilities. So what we need, I think, is a what I call a civil and reasoned debate, national debate, where these questions are put on the table. And some people are going to buy into the new model, some people aren't. But until they can be discussed, you know, we can't get to first base. I believe that this phrase that the fellow used at the Motivator blog, you can't beat the market. I mean, I think that phrase is evil. And that's the core premise of passive. But why do I say it's evil? Because they trust the market. It does express where they're coming from. They trust the market. But it's begging the question. The whole question that's being raised in rational investing is, does the market get it right? The core premise is that the market sometimes gets it wildly wrong. And if the market gets it wildly wrong, obviously you don't want to trust the market. But they start with the premise that the market is always right. When they say you can't beat the market, the theory is that the market is intelligent. But if the market's intelligent, why did they value stocks at 3x fair value? That's the question under debate. You can't assume your conclusion. That that you can't beat the market. We can never innovate. No one can ever come up with another good idea beyond what the passives came up with in the 1960s and the 1970s. It's over. We can never question anything because you can't beat the market. Can't beat the market. Can't beat the market. I mean, that's an answer to anything that comes up. It's just, it's mindless. It's certainly true that you should be skeptical of claims that people can beat the market. That's a good idea. Being skeptical is a good idea. But there is no iron law that you cannot beat the market. There are circumstances in which the market just gets it wrong. And I think a case where they get it wrong is when stocks are overvalued or undervalued dramatically. Those are cases where the market gets it wrong. Those are cases where it makes sense to change your stock allocation in response to price changes. Now, the last point I would make about backtesting is the key, you know, as I said, both sides use backtesting to support their case, and both sides use the same data set. So to argue that the data is not good is an empty argument because we're both using the same data set. But I think the key in any discussion of whether, you know, backtesting has been used well or poorly is, can you offer an explanation for the result? You know, going back to the whole miniskirt thing and the whole thing about buying stocks in January versus October, does the theory hold up? If the theory doesn't hold up, I don't really care what the backtesting says. I'm not going to go with something unless the theory is very solid. Backtesting, to me, the role of backtesting is to confirm. Backtesting is valuable, but it's always secondary. It's always to confirm, in Rob Bennett's opinion. So I feel that what I need to come forward with is an explanation of why so many people came to believe that it's not necessary to look at price. And I think I've done that. And I'll be brief because, you know, we've already gone over time. I think the problem is that, as I say, our knowledge of investing is primitive. The first effort in history to quote-unquote rationalize investing was the development of the passive model in the 60s and 70s. And it was a first draft. And humans get things wrong in first drafts. And the really unfortunate thing that happened is they learned that they got it wrong in 1981, or they should have. That's when Shiller came out with his research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. But there's a big problem with rationalizing the investing process. And the problem is most of our knowledge of investing comes from the stock selling industry. And they obviously have a financial motivation to promote passive investing because passive investing says buy stocks all the time. You know, what could be better for the industry? So one thing, they've got a huge conflict of interest. And two, it made them look somewhat foolish. You know, I think every sign I see shows that they were sincere in believing that passive investing worked when they first developed the theory. But they look somewhat foolish when Shiller showed that valuations affect long-term returns. And when people look foolish and they stand to make hundreds of millions of dollars, the pressure for them not to change the theory was huge. And so as a result, their inclination was to poo-poo the research. Say, well, that's interesting, but, you know, and that's what they did. And in ordinary circumstances, that wouldn't have worked. In ordinary circumstances, that would have blew up in their faces. But through God's plan for us, sometimes inscrutable, all of this happened at a time when stock prices were at the lowest they'd been in a long, long, long time. In 1981, the P/10 level was about 8. It was half of fair value. So in 1981, when we discovered that passive investing could never work in the real world, we were living at a time when if we covered that up, we could go 20 years with great returns. And nobody would be upset about the cover-up. So that's what we did as a people. It wasn't any one person. It was everybody. I mean, it was the financial press. It was the stock selling industry. It was the politicians, the economists, Greenspan, the Fed, everybody. The stock buying public. We all cooperated in this massive cover-up. Not really deliberate, but, you know, we knew about it. Our common sense told us it couldn't be true. But we didn't want to hear that. And we all participated. So from 81 through 2000, there was no penalty to pay for all this nonsense. And the passives to this day claim credit for those years. Ask, you know, mention to a passive that their ideas don't add up and they'll say, hey, we had great returns in the 80s and 90s. But of course, from 75 through 95, and rationals had great returns. They had the same high stock allocations as passives. So passive doesn't get credit for that. That's a neutral. The only years that passive beat rational were 96, 97, 98, 99, 4 years. In those years, they're superior. But rational has been superior from 2000 through 2009. And that fits the record. In other words, if you go back through the historical record, that same pattern always applies. Passive always has a couple years where it is superior. Not by accident. It's supposed to be that way. The rationals deliberately stay out of stocks when stocks are overvalued, and they miss rallies because they don't care. The risk of holding stocks in 96 through 99 was sky high, and the rationals are long-term investors, and they're not willing to hold stocks in those circumstances. So that's an alternate explanation of what happened. It's basically a freak occurrence. The only reason passive is popular today is that a lot of experts endorse it, and a lot of middle-class investors like it. And the middle-class investors like it because of this quirk that they gave passive investing credit for something it didn't deserve credit for, the good returns from 75 through 95. And the experts endorse it, I think, primarily because they're in the stock selling industry, and it's a bonanza. It's a financial bonanza. Again, I don't say deliberate, but I don't think it can help but influence them. In other words, the experts know that there's a valuation problem, but they don't want to know. They don't want to know. There's cognitive dissonance there. They don't want to know it. They don't want to study it. They don't want to learn. And I think we have to learn. Anyway, that's my answer to the claim that valuation-informed indexing works only because, you know, only be, you know, that it's only a backtesting phenomenon. It is not a backtesting phenomenon. It is common sense that taking price into consideration when setting your allocation must work. It does always work in the backtest, but it's also worked on a going forward, not backtested basis, and it's always going to work because common sense. There is no way a rational human mind can imagine a circumstance in which it would not work. And the debate here is, yes, the rationals are trying to beat the market. We'll proudly acknowledge that. We think the market is nuts when we go to the prices that we saw from 1996 through 2008. So yes, we're trying to beat the market, of course. The market's nuts. Of course we want to beat it. We don't want to cooperate with it when it's nuts, do we? But the passives are looking for a way to beat common sense. They're thinking that there's some way to invest in which ignoring price could be a good thing, and that defies common sense. So that should be the debate. That should be the debate. And it's healthy to have our ideas challenged by those who point out that there is backtesting involved, and backtesting is sometimes a bad thing. That's healthy. But just using the word backtesting doesn't prove the case. You need to make a stronger case than that, in my opinion. Good luck with your investing strategies. Thank you.